Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. Super excited for our new way to do this. We've been thinking about we should do these live.
Yes.
So not only should we record the audio, but we should record live, right?
Everybody wants to see our emotions when we talk about, because we are very passionate.
We are passionate people. We are.
And everybody's like, you guys talk so much and use gestures, and we're like, we gotta video it.
Tonight, I'm really excited because it's our first inaugural episode of doing it this way. We're recording audio, we're going live on video. It's gonna be really cool. And we had to bring in a special guest, Dr. Justin Paugh.
Yep. UT, and, proud.
And then even better than that, I should say that downplays you, but he's faculty. Our guest tonight, our official guest, we're kind of a guest co-host, co-host in Justin, but our official guest, Dr. Jim McKee.
Yeah, hey, yo.
Dr. Jim, welcome.
Thank you, guys. It's great to be here.
This is going to be fun. You're in Ohio, right?
I am outside Chicago, actually.
Okay,
nice.
I get Illinois and Ohio and Indiana confused.
Same thing.
They're like 2 inches apart.
All in the Midwest.
All those Midwestern states. Well, sweet. Okay, Doc, here's how we like to do this stuff. I'm super excited to have you on just because both myself and Justin are in the middle of going through Spear stuff.
And I'm here to learn about Payman's the Spear stuff.
Payman's been going through Dr. Coyce's stuff. Mm. And so it's really been, we're kind of young dentists trying to figure stuff out. And I thought it would be great to have you on because one, you're resident faculty down at the Spear campus. You still practice. And so I'd love to kind of, the best way to start this out, I feel like, is really just to kind of hear your story, sure. How you got into dentistry, how you got into working with Spear. Just kind of lay it out for us, and we're going to jump in, interrupt, and ask questions.
I graduated in 1984 from University of Illinois Dental School, and I had no clue what I was going to do. I bought a practice in Downers Grove, which is a suburb of Chicago. It's about 45 minutes from downtown. On the first day in practice, I saw an amalgam buildup patient at 8 o'clock and an endo patient at 4 o'clock. There were a lot of days like that. It was a small practice, a really small practice. And I started to get busier. I was working 2 evenings a week and every Saturday. I noticed
were
I
you
was
an associate?
No, I bought the practice from a woman who was there. It was basically a hobby practice for her. She wanted to spend more time with her kids. She was there 2 days a week and she left after 3 months. So really, I needed patience. So
sure.
I did kind of the typical things. I did welcome wagon from Chamber of Commerce. I tried to get involved in the community. And what I noticed was I was building a patient base of patients who, when I presented a treatment plan that was technically perfect, the first question out of their mouth is, does insurance cover this? And all of a sudden, I started to think, there's got to be a better way to do this. I kind of stumbled around for a couple more years, got a little more busier, and I started to realize that one of my deficits in treatment planning and diagnosis was occlusion. I really didn't understand occlusion very well, and I really didn't understand aesthetics very well. I ended up going to a course that Pete Dawson did many years ago in 1989 in Chicago, and it opened my eyes to occlusion. A year later, I ended up seeing Mark Piper, who's a neurosurgeon in St. Pete, and he opened my eyes up to TMD and the relationship between the joint and the bite. And then from there, it kind of took off. I went to the Pankey Institute. I spent a lot of time with Frank, spent a lot of time with John Coyce as well. I started a study club and started bringing speakers in. And probably by 1996 or 97, I started to teach both at Dawson and Pankey. And I did that for years. I did some of my own stuff too. But really, my focus in my practice was aesthetics and occlusion. I had a busy restorative practice. I still do. And ended up coming to Spear starting last year when they called and asked if I would be willing to do some more work in terms of the occlusion and TMD training as well as the facially generated treatment planning. And I couldn't be more excited. So it's a wonderful place to be associated with. And you meet so many great people. So I've had a blast doing it. So it's really been fun.
So lots of take stuff to take in there. The one question I wanted to jump back and kind of ask is, so as you're, because here's the deal. I want to kind of tailor things back to what our young listeners, new graduates are getting into. They were right there where you are when you're kind of, you're graduating. You don't know how you're going to make, you know, your loan payment, you're worried about paying the payroll, you know, all these things. And that has to be very unnerving to jump into basically, you know, all this, you know, one, you got to take a lot of education because what you're talking about is, you know, that's a lot of education. Sure. And how did you wade through that and kind of decide to do that? Because that seems to be a big hurdle is I don't think we get lots of foundational, you know, we get some, right? But not a ton in dental school. And so then you graduate, and I think a lot of our generation wants to jump into
doing
specialty procedures, placing
luxury
implants.
It's like kind of like luxury stuff, like, oh, I want to be a cosmetic dentist, be like Dr. Yeah. Apa, or I want to be a celebrity dentist. One of the things, and on top of what Soli asked, I want to kind of mention it and ask you. You said that you got to a point where you felt like you're not understanding occlusion, or you felt like you need some more help. What was that, or what did you encounter that made you realize, hey, I need a little bit more basic or foundation or occlusion stuff? Because that is what I want to get into, a point where what other people are needing to do sometimes is occlusion, but they don't know what is it. Like, how did you find out that you like or you need to know more about occlusion?
That's a great question.
I had a case that I'll never forget, and I show it in lecture.
I had a patient. We all have that.
Yeah. It was a watershed. Every dentist has watershed cases in their career, and this was one of mine. I had a patient who came in with worn teeth, and he had worn his upper anterior teeth. There had been some dental alveolar compensation. The teeth had erupted. I didn't realize it. And I made him a bridge from 7 to 11, and I tied it together. I tied it together because the preps were short, and I was afraid the teeth were going to fall off. I made him single unit crowns. He came back a year and a half later for a cleaning, and his lower anterior teeth were destroyed. And they didn't have any wear on them before I put the bridge in. Right then and there, I got a pit in my stomach, and I said, I got to learn more about occlusion. I didn't understand anterior guidance. I didn't understand aesthetics because I created an occlusal plane that was longer in the anterior than the posterior. And right away, I started to get really hesitant about presenting restorative cases because I was afraid the same thing was going to happen again. So that was really my watershed moment. I had a lot of patients coming in with clicking joints too. And I said the typical thing, don't chew gum and you'll be fine. Get physical therapy. Yes. There was no diagnosis. I had no idea what I was watching. And, you know, I try and make some type of an appliance that had no chance of working because the condition of the joints hadn't been diagnosed. And then when that didn't work, again, you get kind of hesitant about recommending treatment planning. And I started to notice I had a little bit of paralysis by analysis where I started to get afraid about recommending treatment planning. And all of a sudden now it got a little more difficult to meet your payroll, to pay your rent, to pay your loans. And fortunately, that's when I started to learn more about occlusion. And that really changed the practice in an unbelievable way. So that's kind of how I got into it. I started seeing cases that I was scared of. It's really what it came down to.
Sure.
So I went to FGTP, which is facially generated treatment planning,
okay,
back in, and I kind of had the same, I realized that I was missing stuff. Yeah, like I would, you know, because I kind of did the same thing. I jumped into trying to do more specialty procedures, so I was trying to do a little more adult ortho, or I was trying to do some grafting stuff, and I realized that, okay, some cases worked really well. Some cases worked not so well. And I'm doing the same thing, so is it potentially that I'm just not treatment planning these cases appropriately, right? That it's not necessarily that I'm doing something clinically wrong. It's just that I didn't see the picture, and so I just missed it.
I didn't have any concept of treatment planning. I was basically a tooth carpenter. I would do one tooth at a time, and on patients who needed more than one tooth at a time, I'd do them. But I had no idea of how to put the system together in a way that it would work both functionally and aesthetically. It was like the only thing I knew how to do was change the spark plugs in a car. If they needed the spark plug changed, okay, I did great. If they needed something else done, it didn't happen. Or if it happened, it didn't happen very well. And, you know, patients understand that. When you have things that don't go well, they kind of leave your practice. So it was a time of unrest in my mind because I was really not confident in many of the treatment plans that I would start to recommend, especially on bigger cases. I remember saying to my periodontist, I want to be more comfortable doing bigger cases. Where should I go? And those were the questions that kind of came back up. And, you know, I heard go to Dawson. I heard go to Panky. I heard go to hear Frank, go to hear John. And that's kind of what I did. And putting those together, that kind of helped put the pieces together in my practice. But, you know, it's tough because when you're a young dentist, you don't have a lot of money. What I would do is I would pay ahead for the CE courses. I'd have them charge my credit card $300 a month, and I wouldn't go to the course till the course was paid. So for me, that gave me some financial security to be able to go to a course and not have to worry, how am I going to pay for this? So I really liked doing it that way, because that way I didn't feel like I was over my head financially going to a course that really I was hoping was going to help me do more in my practice. But really, from day one, when I went to a CE course, what I was looking for was something I could take home and I could implement. You know, I went to a lot of CE courses that you could go to and was interesting material. But when I got back to the office Monday, I had no way to put it into practice. So for me, you know, since I've been teaching now 25 years, my whole goal is to make sure that the material that we talk about can be implemented on a regular basis when you go back to your practice.
So a big thing I noticed too that I kind of saw was I was treatment planning, and y'all jump in and touch base here too on this. I feel like we're taught to diagnose decay and gum disease, but we don't talk about any sort of like myofunctional issues, occlusion issues, and or, you know, when I treatment planned, it was like, okay, there's a cavity here, there's an abscess here, and we need to do scaling root planning in these two quadrants. It was, but not looking for where, you know, recession, those type of things. And so it started, like, you realize all of a sudden you just see differently because there's more
to the story.
Exactly.
Just
because a patient will walk in and they have no decay, no gum disease, no problem whatsoever, but they're destroying their teeth.
And then you're like, what am I going to do? Am I going to refer to who is going to fix this?
Yeah.
You know? Well, that's what I would do. I'd refer those cases out because I didn't know what to do.
Right. I mean, maybe and make an eye guard, hope it works.
Exactly.
And I started to realize, why am I referring these cases out to someone else? If I learned how to do them, all of a sudden my practice could be a very different practice. So for me, most, you know, Frank said something many years ago that stuck with me. He said, you treatment plan what you see first. And that's kind of how it was in the mouth. When I was a young dentist, I saw decay and I saw gum disease first. As I progressed in my learning, I started to see occlusion first. I started to see aesthetics first. And that's when I was able to start to put together more comprehensive treatment plans. And not only put together the treatment plans in a way that made sense, I was able to present them to the patients in a way that made sense. Because that was the thing I was lacking. I couldn't present it to the patient in a way that the patient understood the problem and my solution made sense.
Talk about how you case present now versus how you case presented back then.
Boy, it's so different. I got to tell you, now the first thing that happens when a patient comes into my practice, I sit with them in a consultation room and I spend some time getting to know what they want to do. You know, I heard a long time ago from Dr. Panky had a comment. He goes, don't forget there's a person on the end of that tooth. Really, right now, I'll go through an initial consultation where I'll kind of get an idea of where they are in terms of their dental awareness. Do they have high dental awareness? Are they relatively ready to move through a comprehensive treatment plan? Or do they have low dental awareness? And do I need to take my time and start to educate them and bring them up to a level of awareness where now they're able to start talking about things on a more advanced level? When I first started doing treatment planning, I blew people out of the water. I would present an entire treatment plan. There was a correct treatment plan, and I'd present the fee, and they'd walk out of the office because they didn't understand their problem. I was presenting a solution that was correct to a problem that they didn't understand. And all of a sudden, what the patient thinks then is, this guy's trying to get in my wallet. So for me, what I do today differently is I spend more time upfront with the patient before I even look in their mouth, getting an idea of what their past experience has been with other dentists. Are they have any concerns about dentistry? Anything past or positive net negative dental experiences? Is there anything like they'd like to change about their mouth? Are there any special circumstances that I need to be aware of when we're talking about treatment? The most common things we hear are fear, scheduling, or financial issues. Sometimes they'll say, no, finances aren't a problem. I have insurance that covers everything. Right then, we stop and have an insurance discussion about insurance and talk about the realities of what dental insurance is today. You know, a lot of times dental insurance gets in the way of comprehensive treatment planning. And I have learned over the years that if I address that earlier in the discussion, as opposed to leaving it later in the consultation, my case acceptance skyrocketed. So those are some of the things that I'll talk about. The second thing that I do before we go back into the operatory to look at their mouth is I introduce different dental problems. I'll say, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, a lot of times in dentistry,
this is gold.
We focused on the pain-based issues, but it's a lot like going to a physician. When you go to a physician, they check your blood pressure. They check to see if you're hypertension. They might draw blood to see if you have diabetes. And what they're doing is to trying to diagnose active disease states that don't hurt. We have the same things in dentistry, although since we've been a profession of pain management, typically we look at the things that hurt. Many times people present with wear through their enamel layer. They present with the gums receding and exposing the softer root surfaces. Sometimes we see arthritic changes in the jaw joint. So we'll talk about decay and gum disease, but we'll talk about the other things as well. And then we'll decide what works best for you. So what I'm trying to do is to set the table. So if I look in their mouth and their teeth are worn, if I say your teeth are worn and they say it doesn't hurt, then all of a sudden right away there's a roadblock there. I want them to know that that's a situation that they may want to know more about. So they may be more open to the discussion. So what I try and do is to help them understand what the potential problems are in their mouth. And then when I talk to them about them, it's not the first time they've heard them. That's worked really well for me over the years.
What do you do when someone kind of shuts down with that? Because, like, you know, those open-ended questions I've seen have been so valuable since coming back from facial surgery.
Yeah.
And trying to basically ask that, and really that it's so counterintuitive than what we were taught in dental school, because we want to jump into their mouth, tell them what's going on, tell them what they need, tell them all their problems, but we never ask what's wrong. I mean, I didn't do that. Were y'all doing that?
No, I haven't done that.
I mean, right now I almost gotten to a point of when they start talking about insurance, because they say that, like, how much my insurance is going to cover. I just say that insurance is not really a real insurance.
It's
like dental insurance. It's a coupon code that is kind of like a restaurant. You came in for a 10% discount, and I could do that. However, they can only give you 10% for certain stuff, not everything. So that kind of, like you said, that kind of sets the tone up for some of them that they are more serious and some that are not. So it helps a lot. And that's one thing that we didn't know. One thing that I guess the major thing that you mentioned was you sit down and communicate with the patient before you even jump into their mouth and see what's going on. And that was so valuable, because it is just exactly what I'm doing now, where I just sit down and I just talk to them for 4 or 5 minutes, nothing about dentistry even. I just talk about what's been life like, you know, just to get to know them. And then they start already talking about, oh, I hate my last dentist, and this is what happened. And it kind of psychologically gets me ready to where, okay, I don't want to be that dentist again for
them.
That's
a great point. Where it's like cherry picking the good information. Actually, like, okay, well, and I don't want to oversell them. I don't want to offend them by, you know, talking about that.
But they tell you everything as far as what you need to know. All those data that they're giving you already before, and you just sit down and chit chat, and they're like, wow, you know so much. And you're like, okay, I'm not going to be presenting you with $40,000. Let me start with something else. You know, like, let me change my treatment approach with you different, because you're already giving me all these signals.
Yeah. So they educate, show value.
Super.
One of the best questions I'll ask in that initial consultation is, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being good, 1 being poor, how would you rate your mouth? And if they say a 6, I'll ask them what brings it from a 10 down to a 6. If I can look in their mouth and see their missing teeth, they've got worn teeth, they've got an irregular occlusal plane, and they say they're a 6 because their teeth are yellow and they'd like them whitened, where's their dental awareness? Their dental awareness is relatively low. So that's where I have to start my education process. If, on the other hand, they say that my mouth is a 6 because I'm missing a tooth and I'd like to get an implant and I'm concerned because I'm wearing my lower front teeth down, then I can start at a much higher level in terms of my discussion. The problem is, if I don't know that, and I've got a patient who has relatively high awareness and I start low, they're thinking, I need someone who's more sophisticated. On the other hand, if I have someone who's low awareness and I start high, that's when they think you're trying to get in their wallet and it's about the money. So really, what I try to do is I try to find out where they're at, what their concerns are, and then address them on a basis where I'm going to tell you what your problems are, and we can move at whatever pace you'd like. I'll prioritize into short-term, intermediate, and long-term goals in terms of what we may need to do in your mouth, and we'll talk about what the options are. I've really changed over the years from going to a more rigid, dogmatic treatment planning style to a much more interactive treatment planning style with the patients. If it takes me 3 or 4 years to complete the case, that's no big deal. But a lot of those patients don't leave the practice because I give them a chance to stay, maybe start doing phase one dentistry, and then build up the trust and build up their success with previous with the phase one dentistry, so they're willing to do the phase two dentistry.
Totally. One thing I meant when you were talking, and I'm looking back at all these messages, because we have so many messages we're getting from podcast, that some of these dental students, third year, fourth year, mainly, that they're getting, or even second year, and we got even some that are not even dental school, but they're already asking, like, how can I get ready? Now, you're in a position where you're not in the schools, like meaning like some of these people that are going through schools, what can they do at the level of whatever schools they're going through to where they get at least understand and take that time into learning and get ready? Like, I don't want to tell them like, hey, wait till you graduate. And I keep telling them that. But then I think it's also something that they can learn more in school. What have you, is my, I guess my main question is like being in the faculty of such a great institute, you get to see so many different diversity of people, different background from different dental schools. What would you say that the schools could do more, either on the school side or dental students could do more on the students' part, that these they can kind of come where when they get out of school, they don't have all that obstacles and problems and things to where they have to figure it out. They kind of know what they're expecting, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Like something where they take this time in the best value what they're getting. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah, well, like it's, I think it's easy for a dental student to be overwhelmed by what's going on, but maybe what would be small steps and moving towards understanding inclusion a little bit fuller than just the basic, these are teeth, this is a wear pattern, here's a night guard, and there's the door.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I think back when I was a dental student, my biggest worry was getting my requirements done. You know, that's
how it was. Survive in advance.
I don't think at that point I was ready to hear the message about comprehensive practice because it didn't mean anything to me at that point. You know, I'm going to do a plug for what I think today as a dental student may be the most valuable resource out there. And honestly, I think that's the Spear Online program. You know, the digital content that's on that website, if a dental student could somehow ask for that for Christmas or something from someone, if they could get access to the digital online content that's that the Spear Education has put together, there is so much on there that could kind of cut their learning curve. But honestly, I think the reality is almost you have to get out and you have to start getting into the world to start to realize what it is. The second thing, though, I would recommend is find a good mentor in your area. There's a lot of dentists who would help you, willing to help dental students. I always have dental students come to the practice. I have young dentists come to the practice. Anyone who wants to come to my practice is welcome to come in and observe. I love having dentists come in. I love having them over for lunch and talk about cases. Find someone in your community who wants to mentor you. There's enough people out there. And then latch on to them. You know what? From my perspective, I've been in practice, it'll be 34 years in September. Nothing gets me more excited than a young dentist coming to the office to talk about cases. I love that.
Sure.
And the other thing I would say is try and find a study club in your area that you can join. For me, I started my own study club because I wanted a group of dentists that I could learn with. And our study club is 27 years old, and it's probably been the most valuable thing I think I've done in terms of implementing the things that I learned at the courses that I took.
Does your study club have specialists in it? Do you kind of like, is that a good thing to have?
I think so, for sure. And you know what? I don't have any exclusivity. We can have more than one periodontist, more than one orthodontist, more than one lab tech. It's there for learning. It's not there for referrals.
Yeah, that's great.
It's there for sharing information. I do the curriculum each year, and I set it up for each month. So we have assigned topics each month. Study club members are assigned to do things. And it really, it's a great learning club. So if a young dentist can find a study club in their area, or when they get out, start one with new dentists and have maybe some older dentists come in and talk to them. For me, that was a great way to learn. And it still is today, quite frankly. So those would be the things I would recommend. Spear online, find a mentor, and join a study club. Those would be, I think, if I had it to do over again, those would be the three things that I would do.
Yeah, I want to say I agree with Spear Online as being an amazing resource, especially for a young associate. Mm-hmm. When I was an associate, you know, it was 2 or 3 years ago, I had access through the owner of the practice. I had access to Spear Online.
It was awesome.
And I literally just went through from the very first topics and went, you know, easy going down. I started with, you know, how do you take impressions?
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I could take an okay impression, but I want to learn how am I really supposed to be taking impressions, and then just building on what I could do. And, you know, because at that point I was a carpenter dentist. I mean, I was looking to maybe be able to do a crown or two in the morning. And that was going to be it. That was at the skill level, the speed level I could do. But then as I started gaining confidence and building those little pieces, I'm able to move forward. I can start going after bigger pieces because I've got a better foundation and some of the other day-to-day that you're building upon, I think, to make it to that point where you can take over a full case and be able to see someone's occlusion as the system that it is and not just multiple teeth.
Well, what's nice about it, too, is a lot of the learning that we see on a day-to-day basis, too, is it's the bigger style or the comprehensive or the more it's... And the reality is we could use a video on how to take an impression. You know, I mean, you talk about that all the time. I mean, I think you're probably the best at going back to the basics on Instagram. You're always about little tips and tricks that, you know, where these are the things that make break what we do and how we do it.
No, it's great. I love how, because the first time, like you said it best, like he said, there is so much content that is true. There's just so much stuff and it's fun stuff. Like there's so many things you can learn. And just by videos and browsing through the content, because just try to organize all that stuff is just a headache. Think about how you're going to put them together. One thing I'd like to ask both of you guys, because now both of you have gone through the course, the facially generated treatment.
I've gone through the seminar.
Okay, so before and after expectations, what did you expect to learn? What did you hear about it when you went through it? What is the process it, and then what's future?
So that's a great question. So I went through it, you know, first off, why did I decide to take it? I kind of knew that I was missing stuff, right? I mean, the more advanced, I kind of got to that point where I've been out for 3 years now and I was seeing stuff and Dad and I were bouncing things off and I was realizing, okay, I feel like I'm missing something. I need a bigger picture, kind of a more of a 10,000 foot view, so to speak. So then it becomes down, like we talk about, you know, there's a lot of them. There's Pinky, there's Coist, there's Spear. There's so many good ones out there. And for me, being a CEREC dentist and being at the Scottsdale campus where they share campus with Spear and whatnot, it was kind of a natural transition and fit just because they had started doing some stuff together. So I was super excited about it because I had seen kind of people in there talking about it and whatnot. And so I was like, let's jump right in. And then they kind of have it out, I'm sure, I think just like Course does, where it's kind of facially generated treatment planning is kind of like the first one.
Right.
And so I didn't really know what to expect, so to speak. I came back and really, I joke, I can't unsee what I see, you know, and Dad will tell you, like, it's amazing now. I walk into a treatment plan and I'm like, it used to be, let's jump to what I can fix, right? You got two crowns and a root canal and three fillings. We'll see you on Monday to book it. And now I'm like, your teeth are on the wrong position. You're wearing, you know, irregularly here. There, you know, you've got some popping in your joint. Like there's so many more things going on that I could jump in here and fix it. But then what inevitably happens a lot of times is, you know, let's take a crown, for example. A patient walks in, they need a crown. For whatever reason it is. I'm saying they need a crown again. I'm getting back
to that. Why used to be $2,000 treatment plan, now it's
$10,000. Well, yeah. So patient walks in and they've got the Kaner crown, so they need a crown.
Right.
Well, what I would find sometimes is, and Doc, you chime in on this if you want. Is that, you know, sometimes if it's a second molar and it's their first centric stop or something like that, and again, I got to take occlusion to figure this out more, but like I'd never used a leaf gauge. Mm-hmm. So they would come back after I did the crown and they would be sensitive. And I'm like, well, their bite hasn't changed. This seems to be. But what was happening was that was their first
point of contact.
First point of contact. And then I was basically changing that completely at that point. I had no idea that I was changing it. And so then it was an immediately change to them. And so that could potentially be a cause for some symptoms. And so that's kind of how I used to like just jump into stuff. Well, now it's like I'm trying to kind of have a big picture.
Bigger picture too. Yeah.
And move forward.
Even one tooth, you're trying to do numbers two or number, say, 15. Now you're looking at number two before you do number 15. Or you're looking at 31. And 30 before you even jump on number two, which is amazing. What about you, Justin?
No, I mean, I've had a few of those. So getting done with the occlusion course, Dr. Jim and everyone was talking about that same situation where you're taking away a premature contact and all of a sudden the bite's changing. And you know that you took a good impression, you know that things fine. And now that crown has no chance of fitting because everything's shifting.
You keep reducing, and it keeps closing, like there's no space.
I've got one particular patient that I know that definitely happened on because everything's perfect. And for 2 months, I'm making adjustments. Bite looks good. Just coming in 2 weeks, it's hurting again. And I know it's not endo. I know the bite's changing. And that's when I realized I've got to do
something.
And
I feel like a lot of dentists will just be like, oh, you need a root canal.
Yeah.
And that's not, what do you think about that, Doc?
Are we
missing the boat completely over here?
The whole purpose of that course is to create an awareness. That's really what it is.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Exactly.
It changes the way you think about dentistry. And I think it takes you away from being a tooth carpenter, and it brings you into the world of being a comprehensive dentist. And I think it's a really powerful course because it has the impact that is so strong that if you go home and implement the things that we talk about, your practice will change. Nothing that we talk about in that course is hard to do. So it really isn't a difficult thing. But more importantly, I always say the problem isn't between the patient's condyles. Many times it's between the dentist's condyles. Our job is to change the thought process of how we look at cases, how we talk to patients, how we treatment plan, how we interact with our specialists. That's the purpose of that course, is to create an awareness about how to develop an interdisciplinary team that can do comprehensive dentistry.
So the next step is occlusion.
So what's the next step? So how do you guys, you went to an occlusion course. How do you get occlusion before you do the facial generated?
Occlusion is a seminar.
They have them both.
The workshop.
Seminars. Can you explain that, Doc, the difference between seminars and workshops?
Yeah. Sure.
Seminars are basically large lecture, probably 250 to 300 people. And I've always thought of continuing education in two ways. One is mind expanding, like a seminar, something like that. The other is more hands-on implementation. That's more the workshops. The workshops are 36 people. They're designed really well. We have numerous visiting faculty that will help out. So there's never a problem having someone being able to help you with something. And those are the hands-on exercises that you take back to your practice to implement what you hear in the seminars. Now, you'll be able to implement a lot from the seminars, again, depending upon your experience. But again, the workshops really cement those concepts and allow you to go home now and practice with confidence. That's really the difference between them, I would say.
So tell me what to expect about from occlusion in September.
Your head is going to be full. It is going to be very thick by the end of it.
The occlusion workshop?
Yes, sir. I'm coming in September for the occlusion workshop. So it's funny. My dad used to always say occlusion is always the answer. And then it's been our joke. Once we got a comb beam, our joke's in it, an abscess is always the answer. But because we used to adjust bites out of occlusion and then they would hurt again. That's been kind of the joke since we got comb beam. But what am I going to expect at occlusion, the workshop?
You're going to have a fabulous 3 days. Basically, what we'll do, we'll start out on day one with some lecture material to set a foundation. And we're going to talk, really, I think when we talk about occlusion, we need to redefine occlusion. Because when we talk about occlusion, if I ask 10 dentists who were 3 years in practice, tell me what occlusion or define occlusion for me. Typically, what they're going to say is occlusion is how the teeth fit together. And I'm going to suggest that we think about occlusion a different way. Occlusion is how the lower jaw fits to the upper jaw. And there's three areas of articulation. The teeth are one. The right joint fitting against the right joint socket is number two. and the left joint fitting against the left joint socket is number 3. So what we're going to do is we're going to expand our thought process from occlusion to think not only about the teeth, but also about the joints as well. So what we want to do is we want to take a more comprehensive look at occlusion. From there, we'll go ahead and we'll start to be able to get confidence in terms of being able to find our initial point of contact, to do an occlusal examination, to recognize the occlusal problems. We'll start to get some bite records so we can start to mount cases. And then we're also going to make an occlusal appliance. So in day 2, we'll make an occlusal appliance that you can go home with and be pretty comfortable starting with occlusal appliances. Day 3 will be a lot of treatment planning. We'll have different cases that we'll treatment plan from what we've learned day 1 and day 2. And then day 3 is going to end, and I do a section of implementation on how do you take this home and how do you do it in your practice. From a staff perspective, from a patient perspective, from a financial perspective, from a profitability perspective, and from a confidence perspective. What are the things we need to do to be able to become confident in taking this material home and actually putting it to work in the practice? It's a fabulous 3 days. We've just redesigned the course. I teach it with Darren Dieter, and we've done 2 of them, and the reviews have really been excellent. So I'm really excited about the, we have another one coming up at the end of the month. So it's really been well received, and I think you're really going to enjoy it.
I'm pumped. We're excited.
Would you suggest that Sully needs to try to do the occlusion seminar first, or by doing the workshop, are you going to be able to walk through a lot of the different philosophies that y'all opened up during the seminar course?
You know, we're going to be doing the occlusion course in July in San Francisco. Again, I've always, occlusion has been the foundation of my practice. So if you can take the occlusion seminar, that's great. I don't think you have to take it for the workshop. But for me, I couldn't get enough occlusion as a young dentist. So I would encourage you to take the seminar and then go to the workshop. If you can, if you can just can go to the workshop, go to the workshop. You're going to take the occlusion seminar sooner or later. So whatever
the reality is that it's not the first time I hear something that's like, you know, usually it takes 1 or 2 times to, I mean, we've done that with CEREC courses. When I audited the, you know, interior course, it was like the second time through, I took home way more nuggets than I did the first time, just because you've got enough of a foundation versus it's not like you're getting punched in the, because I think that's actually something I noticed I took home from taking facial adjourned treat planning was I was like, I'm glad that I've kind of practiced for a couple of years, that I've made some mistakes, because for me, I was able to take home a lot more just because I
understand it. So much
I was like, that's why that happened or whatever. So I definitely see the value in a seminar before sometimes, because it starts to get your wheels turning on the concepts.
It's the failure that makes us so much learn so much more. The complications is what allows us to learn, but we don't know until we go to a course.
You learn way more from failures than from successful cases, I promise you.
Another thing I like about what Sully's doing is, he's been out for a little bit, but he's also still early enough in his career that he's defining, you know, what kind of dentist he wants to be. Now, you know, granted, there are 40-year-old dentists out there who are defining what they want to be, and they've decided they want to practice dentistry different and are very capable of changing, but they're still, you're just a great example of momentum. And deciding that you want to start moving in a direction and being able to make the steps and decisions.
Feel like he's got into this role. He's got to take so much.
I
keep talking about it. Now I got to take it.
That's because you set the bar. What Paymon's not telling you, Doc, is that he took like 800 hours his first 2 years of out of dental school CE. He's placed over like 2,000 implants. The guy's like a magician when it comes to it. He's like
It's fun. I learned so much talking, like we were talking about some of the CE back in Scottsdale, that I learned so much by just interacting with other dentists and understanding their cases and then their experience of their patients and then mine. And then we talk in these CEs is what really made it. It's not just going to the CE, but also creating that network, which I think you've done a great job of, knowing so many people in the field, being only a dentist for 2, 3, 4 years. And I think that allowed us so much more. I think that understanding and talking with peers, because a lot of my friends, I feel like the ones that do ask me the most questions about, like, I don't want to say the most basic stuff, But the ones that are asking some of the very simple questions or the things that they're like, oh, what happened wrong? I'm like, they never gone to CE, or they're just looking at online to see how many hours they need to fulfill their 40 hours of requirement. And I feel bad inside, but I tell them everything I can and try to encourage them. Hey, dude, you got to go to see some of this.
Education's key.
Right.
You guys are so far ahead of the game doing what you're doing. You know, I've said for years, I think the best investment that a young dentist can make is in CE. You know, I've seen a lot of my colleagues over the years who just did exactly what you guys were talking about. They got their hours that they needed for state licensing, and that's it. Those dentists don't enjoy dentistry. You know, the dentists my age that really enjoy dentistry are the ones that went to CE, the ones that challenge themselves to learn more, to implement into your practice. I love going to work every day. I mean, I absolutely love going to work every day. I mean, you know, I've been doing this a long time, but I really believe the reason that is because I was able to start to get a foundation early that allowed me to know what type of dentist I wanted to be. And then from there, it was just going after it. It's all out there. You just have to know what you want, and then you can get it. So I really commend you guys for doing what you're doing at your age.
Well, and my thing, what I always tell people too, is like the earlier you take it, well, and so I think somebody posted this on Facebook, I think Tarun posted or something, the earlier you take the CE, the longer return you get on it. So it's totally. Like if I learn to do something now, I'm going to get such an excessive return versus if I wait 5 years, I'm gonna miss out on so many opportunities that I could have diagnosed.
So many patients.
And now that's what's happening to a degree is I come back and I'm like, I see a patient that I did like years on and I'm like, gosh, I really compromised the outcome of that case aesthetically by not seeing the big picture, you know, by jumping into, oh, she wants to do six veneers, let's do them, but not thinking the teeth are on the wrong spots. You know,
I do have to give you a little tip. That feeling never goes away. I mean, even after all these years, that feeling never goes away because you look at, I look at cases today that I did 6 months ago that I would do differently. So that's cool though, because it continually challenges you to be able to make yourself better, to be able to help your patients. That's really what it's all about. You know, all the CE that we do and everything that we talk about, it's ultimately about helping patients. And that's why I think most of us got into dentistry was to help people. And I think the really fun part of pushing yourself and learning more and pushing the boundaries is because I feel that I can help patients in a way better than I could 6 months ago.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. So tell us, main question remains, why lift gauge after all of these years instead of a deprogrammer?
Here he goes.
Instead of a nice,
I just got my lift gauge.
There's three ways.
Tell us in the simplest terms, why?
There's three ways to seat the joints. You can use a lift gauge, you can use a deprogrammer, or you could use bimanual. And honestly, I think whatever method a dentist chooses is typically how they learned. For me, I learned bimanual, so I use bimanual a lot. Again, leaf gauge and deprogrammers, both are a way to seat the condyles. They're an indirect way because they separate the teeth and let the muscles do it. Bimanual is the same way. You just are able to seat the joints and, again, take the muscles out of the equation. So they all work. And I'm not as hung up as I was when I was a younger dentist on which way is the best. Sure. I think the goal is not necessarily which way you do it, but what information do you get when you seat the joints in the socket and, quote, read the bite? Because for me, diagnostically, that's the key to the whole discussion. How big is my shift from a fully seated condylar position to maximum intercuspation? Is it to the right or is it to the left? Do I have a midline discrepancy in a seated condylar position? Those are the things that lead me into the discussion with the patient relative to, is the problem at the tooth level? Is it at the joint level? Do I need to get more advanced imaging to take a look at the joints to see if that may be an issue? And that's in the growing patient as well as the adult patient. I find myself today not being hung up on leaf gauge versus deprogrammer versus bimanual. But more importantly, what do you do with the information in the new patient examination to be able to have a dialogue with your patients about what's best for them? Again, I think it's probably what you learned first, that you're most comfortable with. So
how did you learn to buy manuals? Is anybody teaching that still in schools? How did you learn to buy manual manipulation?
Well, I went to Dawson first because, again, really the only game in town. Back, you know, Frank and John were just getting started back in 1989, so there weren't a lot of courses. And back then, there were really only two choices. It was either Dawson or Pankey. I went to Dawson, and that's where I learned by manual. I was fortunate. By manual came easy to me. So I've used by manual for years. Leaf Gauge does the same thing, though. Deprogrammers do the same thing. But again, I don't get hung up on which technique. Realize the benefits of being able to diagnose. You don't have to necessarily treat in a fully seated position. That's not the point. But you want to diagnose there because that opens up an entire array of possibilities of conversation with the patient based upon what you see. I mean, the difference between a 1 millimeter shift and a fully seated position to maximum narcuspation is really a different case than if you have a 4 millimeter or a 5 millimeter shift. Those are different cases. Sure. And no matter how you get there, whether it's by manual, whether it's leaf gauge, whether it's deprogrammer, you need to be able to get there to recognize the case and then have the discussion with your patients.
Sure.
So kind of a question that I'll tag off that a little bit from just a kind of the young guy trying to figure out standpoint. When I'm treatment planning like that, when I get to that patient, because I loved how you talked about diagnosing their kind of their dental IQ, so to speak, or their dental awareness, because that's something that I haven't really heard of. And I don't think I tend to kind of talk to the same level of IQ. If you realize that somebody is just not even in the realm of kind of getting it at that point, how do you talk about that with them? How do you not overwhelm them, but at the same time, you want to show them or treatment plan them? I mean, does that take time? Is that something just because I see that all the time? I think I had that today, actually. A new patient came in. I did this nice, pretty interview. We got pictures. We got all the diagnostics. We did everything we were supposed to do. But then I felt like he was just totally overwhelmed.
I plant seeds. If it doesn't happen today, that's okay. I mean, again, I'll break it into the short term, intermediate term.
Don't fire them.
So the short term. The short-term needs are decay. Those are the things that are going to get markedly worse if you don't do something right away. And I'll tell patients, if a patient's shutting down, what I used to do, being an extrovert and a talker, I would talk more. And all of a sudden, I realized, you know what? That's not working. So basically, I'll take a step back. I'll say, let's think about what we want to do in the next 6 months, maybe in the next year, and maybe in the next 5 years. In the next 6 months, you've got these two areas of decay. Let's take care of those. And then I'll see you for your next cleaning and we'll talk about some other things then. So I try to break it down and bring it back into phase one treatment. Yeah. I didn't used to do that. I used to present the entire treatment plan because that's what I was taught. I'd get models, I'd work up the case, and I'd present the treatment plan and they'd walk out of the office. So if you get someone that's overwhelmed, go slow. Take a step back, do their phase one dentistry. Once they get to see you, once they get to know you, once they get comfortable with your office, they see that it's a good office, their attitude will change. Now, truth be told, not everyone's attitude is going to change, and some people only want the lowest level of dentistry possible. And you know what it comes down to, really, in your practice? It comes down to how busy you are. When I was a young dentist and I needed patients, I took everyone. Now that I'm in a different stage in my practice, maybe I refer those to a younger practitioner in my area who's looking for patients, and maybe they can help build value over the years with them. So it all really depends upon how busy you are in your practice. And there's nothing the matter with that. You don't have to be the right dentist for every patient. Find the ones that you want to treat.
You're never going to be the right one for everybody.
Create value for them.
That's awesome. We got to come hit him up in Chicago.
I know.
You're in Chicago, is that what? Or you're in the suburbs of Illinois?
I'm in Downers Grove, which is a southwest suburb of Chicago. You guys ought to come out to the office one day and hang out. I'd love to have you.
We were talking about it.
I'm flying up there this weekend. I'll be there tomorrow or Friday.
I'll be there in 2 weeks to take the AID exam.
Give me a call when you get here. That would be a blast.
It'll be fun.
But no, I really think the key is reading the patient. And once you start to read the patient in the initial consult before you look in their mouth, that's when your practice changes. That's when my changed, at least. Because again, I used to want to get into their mouth and do the treatment plan. Now I want to know what they want to do. And my job is to help create awareness and to create value. Because quite honestly, most of the patients who come in our practice, have a relatively low value of dentistry because many times they've not been exposed to comprehensive dentistry. All they've done is had treatment plans given to them by carpenter-based dentistry, one tooth at a time dentistry, and they're not used to it. So sometimes it takes a little bit of time for patients to get used to that and to understand what the real value in that type of dentistry is. So for me, the job is to create that value. Some patients, you can go through the process relatively quickly based upon their experiences. Sometimes it takes a longer time based upon their experiences. To me, it doesn't matter. I just want to be able to raise the value. That's what it comes down to.
So true.
Yeah, it's important.
They look at you like you're crazy at first when you start talking about some of this stuff. Because like, for example, talk about overdenture versus fixed. When they come in, they're like, oh, I want fixed. I don't want anything to move. And then you're talking about the lip support and doing like any sort of Botox. And they're like, wait, I only came here for teeth. You're looking at my whole face or like trying to find out what's going on with their lip and everything. So a lot of them.
I learned that the hard way. I'm going to go through one right now. I learned
that the hard way.
I have a case right now that I'm working on where I got to the wax trying of a fixed delivery, and at like laughing high smile, you can see the transition. So I'm
that's learning. The hardest part though, transition lines in a fixed gummies.
Yeah, talking to removable.
So I think we're gonna have to go that route, but it's a learn. I'm like,
well, these are the ones that you learn, and it's good.
Oh yeah, Frank says it the best. Frank, when Frank talked to patients. He'll talk to patients about what the problems are, what the consequences of non-treatment are, and he said, would you like to learn more about this? It's a very non-threatening way. It's a very safe way. It gives patients an opportunity to make an informed decision because so many times we tell them you have a cavity and it needs to be fixed, but we don't tell them what happens if it doesn't get fixed. Or you've got worn teeth. What happens if you don't treat it? What are the potential problems? And I think Frank has really perfected the soft side of dentistry with patient communication in terms of being able to create awareness for patients about what their problems are, but not overwhelm them with feeling them that they're forced into a corner to make treatment choices. So, you know, it's funny. I watched a lot of Frank's videos recently, and I came away with an entire new perspective on how to talk to patients. Even after doing it for all the years that I've been doing it. So I really think he has a nice way of presenting things to patients.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, he talked about wanting to bring patients in, you know, so giving them that opportunity to become involved in your treatment plan.
Sure.
Co-diagnosed, yeah. I agree too. I think
yeah.
So you get a lot of your patients to come back with a second consult, doc, as far as if it's a comprehensive case, you take study models and stuff, and then you present it second appointment. Or do you ever do it the first day that they come in, you give them, here's $20,000 or $15,000 treatment?
No, I never do it now. I used to do it, but I never do it now. My first appointment, I have an hour and a half for new patients mostly. Now, those are typically referred patients who have a problem. So my first half hour to 40 minutes is generally my initial consultation where I get an idea of what their problem is, what they're thinking of, what they'd like to do. Then I'll do my clinical examination. At the end of my clinical examination, I have to be prepared to do a case presentation for diagnostic records, models, photographs, and any joint imaging that I may need. If that's the case, then they come back for diagnostic records, and then they come back for a consultation, for a treatment consultation. So generally, I'm going to see them two times before I present the case.
Would you charge them for the consultations and how much usually, and does insurance cover that?
You know what?
These are great questions.
You got to ask the question.
Like, hey, sure.
I've always kept my exam fee and my consult fee low. I didn't want that to be a barrier to treatment. So my exam fee, you know, it's $125, $175, depending upon the patient. Diagnostic records, I'll do again at a relatively low fee. It might be $250 for everything. And I'll do a consultation. I think we get hung up on per hour production sometimes when I think we should be looking at per week production. Because if I do, you know, if I do two, three new patient exams in one day, my production is going to be low for that day. On the other hand, if I do two large cases at the end of the week, that takes care of the whole week. So don't get hung up, I think, on what the fees are. I'd rather give them an opportunity to hear. That's always what I've done. To keep my exam fee low, and I'll bundle the consultation in with those exam fees. So once they hear and once they understand and once they really realize that they're getting an experience that they're not getting in other dental offices, most of the time patients will say yes. And most of the time, the production per hour takes care of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So it does. Yeah, totally.
I know. I know. I need to know that on sometimes because I track the numbers so tight that sometimes I'll get bent out of shape and I'll be like, but then, you know, tomorrow we'll pay for the production for the whole week. So it's like, well,
no, it's funny because you said the per week of production instead of per day.
That's a great point. Yeah. That's a great point.
Well, Doc, this has been absolutely fantastic and really fun. I got to give one shout out for those of you watching who have seen this. My good buddy, Jonathan Ayala with Interview Media. Thank you so much for doing all the graphics and running this for us. This has been sweet. So if anybody wants to do graphics like this or whatnot, hit Jonathan.
He's very creative and very patient with us. I feel like he's very nice, man. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Appreciate it.
But Doc, thank you. This has been fantastic. I look forward to seeing you in September. If I don't see maybe this weekend or before then. But we're very appreciative of you coming.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jim, thank you. I'll see you in November.
I want to thank you guys. This has been a blast. If there's anything I can do to help in any way, please don't hesitate. And please, I'd love to do this again if that ever fits into your guys' schedule. I really had a blast doing this. So thanks so much.
Sure.
Heck yeah. Wonderful. Hey, be careful what you wish for, though. We might bring on as a guest co-host.
I'd love to.
He's awesome.
All right. Well, thanks, Doc. Everybody work smarter, not harder.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.